But I wanted to sort of just touch base with you a few headline figures, just to sort of think about that. So in China, and from this is from the Independent Centre for Chinese Writers, and it's pretty tough being a China Independent Centre, yeah. I can tell you. There are currently, now they say 50 journalists and bloggers currently detained. They estimate that number is hugely underestimated because they don't know and they can't get all the facts. But there's 50 that they know that they're working for. And of course in 2007, two extraordinary writers, Liu Xiaobao, who was the Nobel Peace Laureate and winner of the various press freedom prize, died in prison due to not being treated. And then we lost Yang Tongyang, who was a dissident blogger. They died of both treatable diseases. And Penn worked very hard to try and assist and try and raise awareness about that, but unfortunately was unable to do much. But from China, and just because we can't do much doesn't mean we should stop trying. I guess that's the message I always take, and that's why I've always been a member of Penn, even though I haven't worked as a journalist now for it's a long time, too many decades. But I feel it's upon all of us to keep speaking up and to make the point about freedom of speech, whether it's in poetry, whether it's in literature, or whether it's in the media. Penn China wrote a beautiful piece and said, "We cannot stand by as more and more of our friends and colleagues are silenced. Where is the voice of Ilham Tohti, the Uyghur scholar and Penn member currently serving a life sentence? Where is the voice of veteran journalist Gao Yu, who spent close to 2 years in prison and is now under house arrest? And where is the voice of Wu Minya, who has disappeared from his holiday home in Thailand and is now being held? Nobody knows." So the view is certainly from our friends in China that we must keep speaking up, even if we feel like we're disappearing into a well that nobody's listening to. I want to touch briefly on Hong Kong. I lived there for over a decade and was there at the handover when it was one country, two systems, and it was all going to be fabulous. There's been just some disturbing turns in the last 2 years, I think, and particularly since Xi Jinping came to power. Most recently, what's happened is the leading financial editor of the Financial Times, Victor Mallet, who's been in Hong Kong for 15 years, writing about the region for the Financial Times, a huge independent paper, his visa has been refused, and he is unable to return to Hong Kong, where his home is, and where his writing is based. So the Foreign Correspondents Club, of which I'm still a member, says, they are appalled at what is happening in Hong Kong. So much hope in 2007. And then the vice president who moderated a talk with a pro-democracy speaker, and that is the only reason that they can see why Victor Mallet was perhaps banned from going back, because he was moderating a panel at a foreign correspondence event. There seems to be no other reason. So that causes us some concern. And here in Perth, we feel a greater affinity in many ways to what's happening in Asia because we are part of the same time zone and most of us travel and read and are part of what's going on in this region. In Burma, I'm particularly concerned as well, and we've been covering the cases of two Reuters reporters, Wa Long and Kwa Shi Shu, who, that's a mangled mouth, it's Chor So U, who currently are jailed in Burma. I use the term Burma just out of interest because I interviewed numerous people from a refugee background who've come to Australia who live here in a collection of stories that I published. One could argue they're short stories, I guess, Dennis. because they both said that they don't consider Myanmar the name of their country. It was imposed upon them. So if you're a Burmese person of Korean background or Shan background, you don't accept the name Myanmar. So I continue to use Burma. Interestingly, our government waxes and wanes on the DFAT website between Burma and Myanmar. If you watch it, why would you? But I do. It changes from year to year. So
Myanmar was a name the generals created when they took over.
So, I mean, I could go on forever here, but I might pass to Marcella. I guess the other interesting country in our remit where we don't pay enough attention is Indonesia. One is concerned greatly with Joko Widodo's sort of position on what he's doing with freedom of speech. So we continue to be interested in what our friends in Penn are doing there. So at the moment as Penn Perth, we're really looking at which issues do we want to get involved in, and which issues do we want to be campaigning for, and we'll be speaking more about that as our chapter meetings. But if you'd like to join us, we welcome. We're a broad church of views, so that's just a picture around the region, if you like, of some of the highlights. And all of that's available largely on PEN International websites. But Marcella.
Thanks, Rose. I'd just like to pick up, before I speak about anything else, just to pick up on something that Rose mentioned, which was Victor Mallet in Hong Kong. I mentioned my brother, who's a career journalist. He is working in Hong Kong for an English language paper. Interestingly, we grew up in a kind of progressive left views, but when I visit him in Hong Kong and I raise anything, even in his own flat, about politics, he toes the Communist Party line, which of course at first shocked and silenced me, because I thought, what's happened to my brother? is unable to be critical. And then when he visited us in Australia, he spoke freely about his real views. And I, without asking him, I put it together that he has learned as a journalist that even in his own flat, he needs to be careful about what he says. His children are there, they go to school, and this at first seemed to me to be perhaps an overreaction, but when I hear about situations like Victor Mallet's, who, as Rose has said, possibly the only reason that he's been denied a visa is because of his moderation of a panel, it doesn't surprise me, because it's common practice for governments who are concerned about what writers and journalists are saying to send representatives to infiltrate the audience to listen to what people say in those kinds of public events. It's easy enough to do. And that's even happened in Australia, not with the Chinese government as far as I know, I wouldn't know, but with the Turkish government, but I'll get back to that a little later. I just wanted to pick up on the Victor Mallet issue. You'll all have heard, I'm sure, about Jamal Khashoggi's murder in the Saudi embassy in Istanbul. And this manoeuvring around the political manoeuvring around how to manage this. Firstly, that it's shock. I'll start with what Peter Rester has said. Our patron Dennis has mentioned him earlier. Rose kindly brought this along. It's in this weekend's Weekend Australian, an article by Peter, and he talks about Khashoggi. He says, Khashoggi's disappearance is shocking for its brazenness and gruesome details of how he was allegedly killed. But after what now seems like to be a golden age of journalism through the late 1990s, the death, disappearance, or imprisonment of reporters is now a disturbingly common. And he goes on to say, while Khashoggi's case is troubling for its brazenness, we must hold on to our anger and demand answers. Not because his story is special, but because it is far too common. What interests me particularly about the Khashoggi case is not only its brazenness and shocking details, but also how Turkey is placed within this. Because in the geopolitical relationships that exist between the US and Saudi Arabia and the US and Turkey, Turkey is the leading imprisoner of journalists in the world. The figures are that at the end of last year, Turkey was jailing at currently 73 journalists, and China, who we tend to think might be doing quite a lot of this kind of thing, is second, who's 41, so there's quite a considerable gap.
And you'd have to think those numbers are wobbly.
Yes, that's the official.
And as well, I think maybe as well, it's difficult when you're trying to get numbers. This person who's got their head in a research PhD thing at the moment, I can just jump in there. You get numbers for journalists. You get numbers for writers that sometimes includes journalists, that doesn't include journalists.
Yes.
So you sometimes will hear different numbers about different writers in different countries. So it is quite difficult to...
It's difficult to get exact numbers, but Turkey has had the highest number of writers in prison, according to Penn's list, year in and year out for at least 25, 30 years. Mm. I mean, one has to say, though, this is in the context in which in China, I think the government's more likely just to shoot you rather than put you in prison. So
yeah. But there's some of that that goes on in Turkey as well.
Yeah.
As the Hrant Dink case and other cases show. And I'm just personally interested to... I always watch Turkey. I think Turkey is strategic. It's strategic, it's geographical position, and therefore a strategic position between... what we call Europe and what we call Asia, and its desire, at least in the 90s and in the early 2000s, to gain entry into the EU, and then its importance, well, at the time when it was trying to gain entrance into the EU, there was some resistance because of its history and its inability to acknowledge the genocide, and there was pressure on Turkey to do that. So this is all of these things come into play, and then of course the West needed access through Turkey to Iraq, etc., and so everything shifted. And continues to shift, as we can see with the manoeuvrings at the moment around this case and what Turkey is trying to manage this with the Saudis and trying to manage it with the US as well. And then we've got the Saudis and the US are in a $110 billion trade deal on arms that Trump has stated more than once in the last week he doesn't wish to jeopardise. So there we are with Khashoggi, and such a stark reminder of a writer or journalist can enter a place that should be a place of sanctuary, and not exit. And I think this is emblematic of, at this particular moment when we're meeting here today, it's an emblematic story about why Penn is important, and why the continued fight for journalists and writers in prison, and who are targeted and in exile, and who are still, even in exile, concerned for their safety. This is an important work, and we all need to be aware that it's something that, as this case shows, something that can happen to anybody, even when you are not within the country who wishes to do you harm or wishes to silence you. It sometimes feels as if, you know, those spy espionage dramas that I love to watch are actually just non-fiction. You know, at the moment it feels like that you realise that truth actually is stranger than fiction. Is there anything you'd like to say?
Writers in prison?
I'll pick up on the writers in prison. We have a branch, an arm of Penn throughout the world is the Writers in Prison program. The way that the program works is through a letter writing program, and that at regular intervals we write letters to the powers that be to on behalf of writers in particular writers in prison. Can't do everyone, so there is a selection, but across the world different pen branches try to do different work. Of course, from time to time there's a particular campaign that's mounted around a particular writer or journalist who is suddenly very vulnerable. Either they're in prison and we've learned that their health is failing, or someone who has disappeared suddenly and we're not sure of their whereabouts and so on. And so sometimes campaigns are galvanised around particular people, but otherwise we tend to work quietly and behind the scenes on a regular basis to make contact with the prisoner, also to let them know that they're not alone. Let them know at least once in a while that it's possible they may get a letter through to them that tells them that there are people on the outside who are aware of their situation and who are working towards their liberation. If you would like to be part of this program, we need letter writer volunteers. We haven't started this program yet, but becoming a member of the Perth Pen and joining the letter writing program, which would probably be one meeting once a month, would be a wonderful way, a very practical and pragmatic way to assist in the work that Penn does. Why letter writing, you might ask, and this has been asked in other forums, why letter writing in the digital age? Well, the reality is that not all of the world has the digital capacity to receive emails, and even if that is the case, emails are much easier to discard. Our tendency to simply press delete when we receive something we don't want to read is we all know that ability. And there's something also about the material, I think, that it's able to be passed from hand to hand, that it's able to be read and reread, that it's able to be held, that it's able to be looked at in a material, physical reality that I think is very important in this work.
It's years ago when email was fairly new, I went to a seminar with someone who was an expert on email, and someone asked a question about, said, what can I put in an email if I really want to get the person's attention? And this expert said, you really want to get their attention, write a letter. Don't write an email.
And I think, even in places where there is digital capacity to use email, now we all know that receiving a letter is an event.
It's a treat.
it makes the correspondence stand out.
And I guess the other thing is, I always used to think, oh, what's the point in writing to the local member? What's the point in actually doing something? Well, the point is that it's logged in the incoming mail. The point is they actually have to respond. That's part of their job. So if they don't know anything about it, they need to know something about it. And it's the dripping tap getting through, and we continue to be there.
Yeah, there are lots of reports. I mean, Amnesty, of course, does this kind of thing for people generally who are wrongfully imprisoned. Lots of reports from writers or Amnesty people who actually get released who say how much it meant to them to get these notices of support while they're in prison.